it's number 40 on the year. Courtney Stephen has the football. Grand to bench it on his 30. He bounces it outside. He's in the room, and he's going to score.
Welcome to Podski Wee Wee. I'm Josh Smith.
And I'm Mike Graham.
So I went to the game this week, Mike, as I do every time the Ticats play at home. And I don't know about you, but I'm a bit of a people watcher. Are you a bit of a people watcher?
I like to observe the odd person.
We'll get into how upsetting that game was in a bit. But during the game, there were these three girls, two blondes and a brunette, sitting about three or four rows in front of us. And they seemed to be enjoying themselves, decked out in their Ticat gear. But they were sitting near a security guard who just kept talking to them all night. The two blonde girls were completely ignoring him. But this brunette, she was sitting on the aisle. And she was like, I don't know if she was into the guy or if she was just playing along. But I go with three other people, and we were all sort of sitting there just astonished at all the things this guy was doing to try to strike up conversation and get their attention. At one point, they announced the 50-50 winner, and he comes running up to them and showing them some sticker he has on his jacket saying it's the winning number. At some point, I don't know if he offered the girl $100, but he says, all I have on me is $100. I don't know what the hell was going on, but we were coming up with all these crazy scenarios sitting there, sort of distracting ourselves from the mayhem that was happening on the field. Maybe it's one of those you had to be there things, but we just kept cracking up, thinking of things that this guy was doing, trying to like maybe lure these girls back to his apartment or something. And at some point they left, and they left a sweater, and then he picks up the sweater to go find them. I'm a judgmental jerk, so I like to people watch and just see what people do when they're not being looked at, and it was just crazy. Have you ever done that at a game, just watched what people do in the stands around you?
I have. There was a long time ago, there was a drunk guy that was like over the top drunk, and he was yelling go like to some fantasy team that wasn't playing, and he just kept going on like go lightning bolts, and I thought that was pretty, he was like, I remember I was probably like, I don't know, maybe 10 or 11. I remember him just sitting, not even in a seat, just, you know, yelling go thunderclouds or whatever it was. But yeah, it's fun to observe people at the game, especially if it's a game like it was last Friday, in which it was a close game. But we'll get into it when we talk about it.
Yeah, that reminds, you bringing up a drunk reminds me of a time I went to a game with my brother. It was the last season to ever win. BC was in town. I think BC ended up just absolutely manhandling the Ticats. But we were sitting there watching the game, and this guy was just super drunk and was stumbling down the steps and was stumbling down the stands. You remember how at Iver Wynn Stadium you could basically walk down the actual seats themselves because they're metal benches. The only interesting part about this is that we were 7 minutes into the first quarter and this guy was that bombed.
I must have been pregame drinking.
We just couldn't stop laughing. And again, you see people out and about around you, and just adds a little bit to the atmosphere. And Iver Wynn Stadium was a different stadium, so you got some weirdos there.
Oh yeah. Yeah, you did, for sure.
All right, so let's get into the game. It seemed to me that this game was essentially decided at the coin toss with that wind that was there. And believe you me, it was heavy, heavy winds. The game was basically over and done with when Calgary won the toss and we're going to get the ball in the fourth quarter. And lo and behold, look what happens. They kick two field goals in the last 3 minutes and win the game again on a last minute field goal. Just a crushing loss. It's a game the Ticats could have won.
Yeah, for sure. I think I said last week that the Stampeders find funny ways to win games. And this was one of them for sure. I mean, Medlock great for us, but that punt really, and I know the wrong time. And once again, Paredes kicks a field goal that sends the Ticats packing.
It just seems like everything went Calgary's way. Like I said, they won the coin toss. There was that one play, I can't remember when it was, but Bo Levi Mitchell fumbles the snap and John Cornish scoops it up and runs for a first down. The Ticats committed all these turnovers. Calgary recovered every single fumble in that game but one. The one when Emmanuel Davis stripped Eric Rogers of the ball and the Ticats recovered. And then on the very next play, like, what are the odds? Michael Ford goes on a run, and if you watch the replay, he makes a cut and he might have taken it to the house. And what happens? Terrell Sinkfield gets knocked down and his foot flies up and he kicks the ball out of Ford's hands. There was the missed interceptions by Brian Hall and Gascon Nadon. Medlock misses a field goal and he shanks a punt. Just seems like everything went Calgary's way on Friday night.
Yeah, that was one of the oddest fumbles I've ever seen. I mean, did you guys see it at the game? Were you aware of what actually happened?
Wasn't aware that it was kicked out, but it looked really weird when they showed the replay on the screen. Couldn't tell that it was Sinkfield's foot, but it was one of those things where we're watching it and Ford cuts to go upfield and he stops to cut back. We're all sitting there going, what the hell are you doing? And that's when we realized the ball was out. It was just a strange play.
Yeah, he probably would have, ran for a touchdown. That was some pretty impressive running on his part, and it just bad luck with Sinkfield's foot flying through the air and knocking the ball out. So just bad luck all over for the Ticats in this game. You know, it's a miracle that they kept in it because they just didn't have any baits, it seemed, the whole night.
Did you also notice the Ticats weren't able to sort of stop any of the intermediate passing routes that the Stamps were running? A lot of swings out of the backfield were working, those short routes were working, and it seemed like they had no answer for it.
In the past couple games, Cornish has been stuffed pretty well by the Ticats, but he was running pretty good, and he got a lot of yards on through the air, too. Yeah, they had a tough time stopping those, 5 to 10 yard passes, so, they did a pretty good job against Calgary, which is a really good offense, but you're right, they just had a tough time with the intermediate stuff.
It's another funny story. We're watching that game, and every time it seems like Calgary's going to run, we knew it was coming, and it was run after run after run, and my friend Richard that I go to the games with at one point just blurts out, I've had enough of this, and it had me in stitches, and it had the rest of us just howling in laughter for a good 5 to 10 minutes that we missed part of the game because I was laughing so hard. And it's now Monday night. The game was over like on Friday, and I still chuckle when I think about it. So if he's not a very animated person, but oh boy, all that sort of, like I said, the intermediate stuff and the run game was just working so well for Calgary that it pissed him off to such an extent that he screamed out loud. And oh man, I'm still wiping away tears thinking about it.
Yeah, it kind of reminded me of a game that I came to Ontario for a visit in the George Cortez year, and it was a rainy night. I believe it was late August, maybe, or maybe even in September, against the Stampeders, and they just couldn't stop the run all night. And it wasn't as bad as that night, but it kind of gave me flashbacks to that game in 2012, I believe it was.
Yeah, and it was an August game, too. That was the game that I sat in the press box at Iverwind Stadium, so I remember that game very vividly. It was Kevin Glenn's return to Hamilton, so I know exactly what game you're talking about. It was a rainy night, and yeah, they could not stop the run to save their lives.
You know, it wasn't as bad as that night, but it was pretty tough. The defense played well, but they weren't at the top of their game, that's for sure.
Just so many things went Calgary's way that it just seemed like Hamilton sort of not shot themselves in the foot, but it's a second game in a row where if they would have limited their mistakes, they probably would have come away with a win. Like that dropped pass in, I believe it was the first quarter, that fell right through, I believe it was a Prelay's hands. That was a giant momentum swing. If they hit that pass, who knows how that game turns out?
Yeah, maybe it gives Matthews a little bit more confidence. He's more relaxed. He plays a better game. Maybe after that, obviously the winds weren't conducive to a lot of passing, especially when you're going against it. But that was a big momentum switch. And if he makes that catch, maybe it's a better game for Matthews and the whole offense.
What did you think about Matthews' performance on Friday night?
I wasn't impressed. It's hard to judge. Like we keep talking about the wind the way it was, but not a very impressive outing by him. He had that pass to Ford that it was probably 50 yards, and I think he finished with 150. I think he had about just under 100 at halftime. So, not big yards. I'm not going to dump on the guy too much because of the conditions at the game, but kind of underwhelming for sure.
Yeah, I definitely would say it was underwhelming, and also just entirely impossible to really judge him based on that. Like you said, those wins were so bad that two out of the four quarters, it really, you just throw out whatever they did because it's almost like you can't get an accurate measure of whether or not he can perform as a starter in the CFL based on that. It's too hard to tell. This week's game coming up against Saskatchewan, I think, will give us a much better indication. The problem there is that if he goes out and throws for 300 yards or 250 yards and a couple of touchdowns, will people be saying, oh, well, he did it against Saskatchewan's terrible defense, so now we got to wait again? It's just tough. There's always going to be a reason to excuse poor play or good play. So I think everyone sort of realizes that Matthews needs to be better. But I think as far as first starts go in adverse conditions, he definitely earned a second start.
Even if he does have a great performance against Saskatchewan, people are going to say that, yeah, but a game's a game and they're playing against pros. Even if it's not one of the best or like one of the worst defenses in the league, that could give him a big confidence boost, just being able to play a good game because he came in against Edmonton and we know how that went, three interceptions, two pick sixes, and then he has a this tough game against Calgary, even if he has a good performance against a poor defense, like, I'll take it. You know, that's a big confidence boost for him. And maybe he improves going forward against tougher teams if he has that confidence boost.
Speaking of Saskatchewan, Kevin Glenn's performance against BC, who I believe is statistically the worst defense in the CFL on yards per game, he was atrocious against them. Three turnovers, he threw for under 200 yards. He was yanked in favor of Brett Smith. I really hope that that performance sort of ends all this insane chatter that we talked about over the last couple of weeks about selling the farm to bring him back to Hamilton.
I just don't think that's going to happen. And Glenn might be they might go with Ryan Smith. So he might be backing up in Saskatchewan from him from here on out, because any slim chance of a playoff spot for the Riders was pretty much stepped on in the game against BC. But we're talking about the Hamilton game right now, so we shouldn't talk too much about that. But I agree. I don't think that the Glenn stuff should be squashed too after that performance.
What did you make of Michael Ford's game on Friday?
I was impressed the way he ran the ball. He's a strong dude. I think, you know, I couldn't tell too much what the pass blocking was like, but Austin was high on him in that respect, so I'm sure he did a good job there. He caught some balls out of the backfield, so he seems to be an all-around back and a good replacement until we get Gable back. I was really impressed.
He had 10 carries for 50 yards and 4 catches for 67 yards, and I too was impressed. What I was most impressed with was how he would hit the hole at full speed. He found the hole and went. He didn't dance around. He didn't try to make something happen out of nothing. He found the hole and he went through it, and that to me is the sign of a good running back. And until Gable gets back, Ford's going to tote the rock, and I think as far as first impressions go, he made a very good one.
Ray Holly's all well and good, but I like what I saw much more from Ford in his short time. You know, he was with us last year. We saw a little bit of him, but I think bringing him back was a good call, because I think he suits the offense much more than Holly or Grigsby did.
Now, there was a bit of controversy near the end of the game. Now, you watching on TV would have had a better vantage point than I would have. There was an illegal contact call on Emmanuel Davis that wiped out Courtney Stevens' interception with about 2 minutes to go in the game. Not saying the interception would have sealed the win for the Ticats. I believe the Stamps ended up going down and kicking the tying field goal on that drive, so it may have set Calgary up to only be able to get the tying field goal at the end of the game. Now, I've heard, though I didn't see it myself, that there was some whining on social media from Ticats fans about how the call was incorrect. As someone who watched the game on television, what's your take on this?
I don't remember freaking out about it. Like, I think I remember that it was, like, I could see how they would call that. So I can't exactly recall it right now, but I do remember that I wasn't pissed off about the call, or I didn't have a big problem with it. So I guess, you know, fans are going to do that. They're going to complain when they think a call doesn't go their way, but I didn't have a problem with the call.
Anything else you kind of have on your mind about Friday's loss?
Well, it was nice to see Speedy B bring back a punt return for a touchdown. You know, it's been a while since he brought one back to the house. He did it early in the game. You know, it was kind of a low punt, so the coverage team didn't have a lot of time to set up, and he just turned the corner and took it all the way. And we're going to need some of that going forward. You know, before the Kolaris injury, this team was championship caliber team, in my opinion. You know, the offense was top notch. The defense was spectacular. The special teams was great, with Banks returning kicks, and, you know, we had Sinkfield that can do stuff back there too, and just it goes on and on. Medlock kicking field goals, being accurate. And now, from what we've seen with Matthews behind center, we have one element taken away from that. Now we just have the special teams and the defense, so it kind of levels out with the elite teams, I think. So it's just tough to see. I'm kind of going on a rant here, but it's tough to see that after you've seen it the whole season, all three phases being so great, one taken away, you know.
Hey, rant away, my friend. That's what this show's for. It's to get your opinions out there. So if you want to rant, go nuts. I'll give you a weekly segment to rant if you feel like it.
Yeah, I just feel like Calgary's a really good team, but they haven't been top-notch on offense all season. And Edmonton's a really good team, and they haven't been good on offense. So I feel like we're right with them now. We're not above them anymore. We're still contenders, but we're on the same level as some of the other good teams in the league.
I haven't found any team this year to be dominant. Edmonton was dominant for most of the first month of the season, save for that first game against Toronto, and Hamilton clobbered teams in August up until they lost to Montreal before Labor Day. That's about it as far as I've seen teams really dominate. We have Ottawa right now who are looking like world beaters, but their special teams unit is garbage. So Brandon Banks could have a field day in those back-to-back games at the end of the season. It's really sort of been like a very, I hesitate to use the word parity, but there's no dominant team this year. There's no Calgary team from last year. Even though the Stamps are, what, 11-3 now? They just haven't been that juggernaut that has been running roughshod over teams. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, that's what I expected from Calgary this year. Well, Levi Mitchell in his first year as a starter was good, and then he had a spectacular Grey Cup game. I thought he'd carry that over into this year. And he's been good, don't get me wrong, but not at the level that I thought he'd be at. So, and in Edmonton, Riley's not playing at a high level either. So those two teams are the top contenders in the West. And then, like you said, Burris and the Red Blacks have, you know, they've been impressing me. I was impressed with that gaming at the Alouettes because, you know, the Alouettes are a good defense and they just shredded them. We're going to talk about it later. But I agree, though, there hasn't been, like, besides Hamilton before the Caleros injury, there hasn't been, like, a top-notch juggernaut in the CFL, in my opinion.
Yeah, we're 5 weeks away from the end of the regular season, and I can think of five teams right now that if they hoist the Grey Cup at the end of the year, it wouldn't really surprise me. Calgary, Edmonton, Hamilton, Ottawa, or Toronto. All five of those teams look very capable of getting hot in the playoffs and running off the two or three wins necessary to win a championship. And in years past, that hasn't always been the case. Calgary last year was the best team from start to finish. And we've seen years where Montreal has just run roughshod over teams. And it's definitely made for a much more interesting season, although I wish Caleros was still healthy, because if so, I think the Ticats would have been the team we're talking about as the Calgary of last year, if you know what I'm saying.
Yeah, exactly. It's pretty open who's going to win the Grey Cup this year. You know, you could go many ways. You just never know who's going to get hot in the playoffs. So it's going to be interesting down the stretch. And then I'm pretty pumped about watching these playoffs, too, because you just never know what's going to happen.
One thing we do know, however, is that we will make bold predictions and we will get them stupendously wrong. This might have been our worst week for picking our bold predictions. You had Jeff Matthews at 250 plus, two touchdowns, no picks. He finished with 155. No touchdowns. Well, he had a rushing touchdown, but he had no passing touchdowns and one interception. I had Terrell Sinkfield at 100-plus receiving yards and two TDs. And, oh boy, he had 14 yards receiving and zero touchdowns. And he fell over at one point on a pass from Jeff Matthews that I had heard during the week in practice that Matthews throws a very, very hard ball. But it was it like, I don't know what it looked like on television, but it looked like, you know, those comic booky things or jokey things where a guy will throw a pass through someone and they'll hit him in the chest and take him right to the wall of a kitchen or something. That's kind of what that reminded me of, and it made me sort of chuckle.
I heard reports that Matthews throws a lot harder ball than Claros did, so it might take some adjustments to get used to his passes for the receivers.
I think he might have also been overcompensating for the wind as well. That wind was wicked. I could say it a million times and it still probably doesn't do it justice. Near 60 kilometer winds, that's insane. And at one point I looked at the goalpost and they almost looked parallel to the field, and I thought they were going to come down. It was that windy. I was standing on the corner at one point waiting to cross the street to go to the game, and I almost got blown off the sidewalk. So I'm no shrinking violet, and that should just tell you how heavy and how hard those winds were blowing.
They were showing them on TV, the field goalpost just swaying back and forth. So, you know, it's tough to perform, especially on offense, in those crazy winds. So hopefully we don't get a lot of that kind of weather down the stretch for Ticat games.
Let's move on from that loss and let's get into some news that we missed last week. As it seems to be the theme of the show, the second we finish recording, the Ticats make some major announcements. They made three this week. They signed Mike Filer and Ryan Bomben to three-year contract extensions, and they picked up former Toronto Argonaut Jahlil Carter. What do you think of these three moves?
Well, I love the signings of Filer and Bomben. You know, that's two Canadian offensive linemen, you know, signed up for a couple of years. They're a big part of the offense. They've been doing a great job this year. So that's two huge signings for the ratio and just for the team in general. The Jahlil Carter signing is great, too. You know, he was a great player when he was with Toronto. He was in the NFL for a bit. I heard that Scott Milanovich said that he's going to have to earn his job back in Toronto or something, and he decided to sign in Hamilton, which, in my opinion, is a good decision on his part. So he's a great player, and he'll help out the secondary in a big way. He didn't really get that much time in this game, but going forward, I think he'll be a big help for this already very good tight Wildcats defense.
Yeah, I'm very bullish on all three of these signings. I have been in Mike Filer's corner for a very long time. I believe earlier this season, maybe even in the offseason, I sort of went on a bit of a rant about people who were anti-Filer, talking about how he deserved to be cut last year after making mistakes. Now he was terrible and all that sort of junk. And if you look at how he has progressed in his second season as a starter, it's been very impressive. And in filling in for an all-time Ticat, a guy that is beloved by fans in Marwan Hage, is not easy, but Mike Filer has done a tremendous job as the team's center this season. And Ryan Bomben, getting him inked to an extension, makes that trade that the Ticats made with Montreal at the draft a win in Hamilton's favor. That was a gutsy call to trade a couple of draft picks for a guy who was a pending free agent. So to get his name on a contract, it's excellent. Excellent news. And Jalil Carter, I'm with you. I like what he can bring to the team. Now, my understanding is he's only signed to the rest of this year, which means he's probably interested in giving the NFL a shot again. But he's familiar with Orlando Steinhauer's defense, having worked under him in 2012 when those guys won a Grey Cup in Toronto. So if he tries to get a crack at the NFL and doesn't work and he ends up back here again, I think he could be a real difference maker in the secondary that now looks to be loaded with talent. We got a question about the team's secondary that we'll get to when we do our questions at the end of the show. But holy smokes, this secondary has got guys that are just... When I list off the names of guys that are going to play in the secondary, that could play in the secondary, it'll knock your socks off.
Yeah, it's a nice mix of, you know, younger guys, you got experienced guys, they're all at the top of their game. So Jalil Carter coming in is just another great addition for them. And you're totally right about that trade at the draft. Yeah, it's nice to get younger draft picks, but they're not always pro ready, so you have to wait on them a bit. Bomben, he's 28 or 29, I think. So he still has, you know, offensive lineman can play for a long time. So I think he's a local guy, not right in Hamilton, but in the area. So
Burlington boy.
Yeah, so Austin probably thought that. Ticats are a great organization, and he probably thought, hey, yeah, he only has 1 year, but we can get him re-signed, you know, him being from Burlington and seeing the way that this team is going. So it was a great call by Austin to make that trade. And Filer did get a lot of heat last year, I think. Like you said, with Hage having such a great career in Hamilton and being so beloved, it's tough to come in and try to replace him. So he's just progressed so much since last year, and he's going to be a great Ticat on the offensive line for years to come, I think.
There is some CFL news to talk about, so let's get into that. The Enoch Mwamba Derby is over, and he landed in Montreal, of all places. Do you think he might be regretting that move after standing on the sidelines and watching that debacle against Ottawa?
Well, yeah, maybe if he wants to compete for a championship, because, they look terrible against the Red Blacks. But I guess they spent the money to bring him in, so he must be happy about that. But he couldn't have been impressed with the Montreal Alouettes' performance last week, that's for sure.
No, not at all. I'm kind of wondering how Montreal can afford all these guys. They bring in Brett Stamps, they bring in Nick Lewis, they sign Sam Giguere. They're not paying Chip Cox pennies. They have some talented players on that team. Maybe it all comes down to the fact that they have quarterbacks who aren't making much money, and from the looks of it, won't be making much money in the near future either.
Yeah, that could be it, because, you know, Kyrus Hebert is probably not making chump change either, and they seem to be pretty loaded at linebacker. I guess maybe Hebert and Chip Cox are getting up there in age, and they're thinking about the future. But yeah, you gotta think that Crompton and Cato, especially Cato, is not making a lot of money, so maybe that is it, the cheaper quarterbacks.
It's amazing how some guys can sign places that look to be places that don't have much in the way of cap space. But again, you know, he's not making his full salary this year. He's making, I think I saw $10,000 a game or something along those lines. So it's mm-hmm. a prorated deal. So Montreal will probably have to shed some salary in the offseason. And like I said, they're saving money by not having a quarterback that's any good on their roster. So maybe they think they'll win with defense and not really worry about the offense so much, which is probably a pretty big mistake, especially in the CFL.
Well, they better hope they're going to win defense, because that offense looks just putrid right now.
So, our buddy Rod Peterson, it seems weekly he sticks his foot in his mouth and says something completely stupid. Last week it was... what was it last week that he said that had us shaking our heads?
CFL expansion to LA.
That's what it was. Thank you very much. I knew you'd remember. Well, this week he takes it one step further, and I'm not sure where this came from. I saw it in a tweet. Maybe it was on his radio show. Maybe it was on his blog. I don't know. I don't follow the guy. I don't want to follow the guy. I think he's a clown. And it's things like this. He said basically that the CFL should become a farm league for the National Football League. And I don't even know where to begin with this stupidity. If you want to start, you go ahead, because I'm just at a loss for words. That's just dumb.
It doesn't need to be. I mean, if you want to play professional football and you're not in the NFL, you want to make a decent wage. You know, I know that CFL players don't make huge money, but if you want to play pro football, you're pretty much a CFL. I know there's the Arena League. I know that there's the FXFL or whatever, they got four teams in that league, and you can go there. But if you want to get a look, if you want to continue your career and maybe get a look at the NFL, you go to the CFL. So there's no reason to make it like an official farm league of the NFL. It's just, we're doing fine. We don't need that. So it's just a silly idea, in my opinion.
If the NFL wants a farm league, they're a $10 billion a year industry. They can start their own damn league. Why does the CFL have to kowtow to these American interests, and why should they change? Like, how would this even work? Would NFL teams send players to the CFL? And when would that happen? Would it be, oh, we have these guys on the practice roster that we want to send to the Canadian League? And what if some of those guys are Canadians that have their rights offered, already signed with it? Like, guys that get drafted in the CFL draft that then go to the NFL and their rights are held, like Christian Covington, his rights are held by the BC Lions. Would the Houston Texans be able to say, oh, no, we don't want to play in BC. We wanted to play here because it's what we prefer? And I just don't get the logic in any of this. How would the guys that come up to the CFL and come to training camp and try to get jobs here, how would they feel if come at the end of NFL training camps in September, which is the midpoint of the CFL season, how would they feel if guys from the NFL were all of a sudden parachuted in and given starting roles or expected to be given starting roles? Like, why would anyone think that NFL players who are practice roster players would automatically come up here and start in the CFL? We laugh and make fun of people for saying Tim Tebow could come up here and play. Why is that any different for an offensive lineman or a safety or anybody else, like a tight end? Or why are we all of a sudden... Why is there people out there thinking this is a good idea? I don't understand it.
I don't see the logic behind it either. I mean, I hate the idea of, with the NHL, they have the AHL and they call up players like midseason. I hate the idea of players from the CFL getting called up to the NFL midseason, losing your stars or whatever. So there's no need for it. We've been fine for years and years and years. It's just a dumb idea. I don't see any advantage to doing that. And we don't need to do that. We don't need to be the NFL farm league. So it's just another crazy idea out of the mind of Rod Peterson, in my opinion.
How would that even work for recalling guys? They send a guy down to the CFL and then 6 weeks later they want to bring him back to the NFL. But is a guy who plays in the CFL for a month really going to go to the NFL and then start? Like, at least in hockey, they call guys up from the AHL and they're on the ice playing. They might only be playing, you know, 6 minutes a game, but they're on the fourth line. They're playing in games. They're not called up to then sit on the bench. None of it makes any logical sense. And I don't understand how anyone who's a fan of the Canadian Football League could get behind this idea.
The NFL did that thing. They did the NFL Europe League. They, like you said, if they wanted to do it, they could, but they don't want to. They tried that. The CFL is, you know, they can get players from the CFL if they want, and they don't have to worry about managing the league, paying players. I don't see any interest in the NFL wanting to do this either. So I don't see it either way, CFL wanting to do it or the NFL wanting to do it.
Let's get into the fun stuff about CFL, not this farm league garbage, and let's talk about some football. Man, yes. We've already discussed the Alouettes and Red Blacks game, but Henry Burris, man. Let me just read the numbers. He set a CFL record with 45 completions. He was 45 of 53 for 504 yards and 4 total touchdowns. He could have had 5. They were stuffed on the 1 yard line on the drive where he broke the completion record. They stuffed him on 3rd and goal from the 1, so he could have had 5 total touchdowns. But I got to think, after that performance like that, I think we're looking at the 2015 MOP. What did you take away from Burris's performance?
It was outstanding. You know, he had a great year when he was with the Ticats when in 2012 when Cortez was there. Their offense was on fire. The defense was their downfall. So, you know, he gets a lot of slack sometimes, and sometimes it's deserved. You know, he makes some dumb decisions throwing the ball, but man, that's the best I've ever seen Henry Burris play, and he's had some really good years and some really good games. But, you know, the Alouette defense is a really good defense. Yeah, we were talking about it last week. Noel Thorpe is a great defensive coordinator, and there's a lot of talent on that Alouette's team, and the Red Blacks and Henry Burris just sliced and diced that whole game. They were unstoppable. It was amazing to watch. And if he can keep that up, I know he can't duplicate those numbers. He probably won't all season, but man, oh man, that Red Blacks offense looks really good right now.
I did not think that they were going to be at, what are they, 8-5 now?
They're tied with the Ticats.
Tied with the Ticats for first, and they got the game on Tuesday against the Argos. What they did to Montreal is what you mentioned there, how Montreal is a great defense. They were just on the field too long. I believe Ottawa had the ball for almost 40 minutes, which is why Burris had so many pass attempts and like the, even just the attempts, 53 attempts. He was 45, like 8 incompletions. Like if he was 20 of 28, you'd look at that and go, that's a damn good game from Henry Burris. The guy was just on fire. And like you said, it's just slicing and dicing, vaunted Alouette's defense up.
You know, he seems to have a lot of chemistry with his, you know, he had the chemistry with Williams back in 2012 and played with Price a bit in Calgary and
playing
you know,
with Ellingson.
Ellingson. So there's a lot of chemistry going on in that passing game, and they're a dangerous team right now because their defense is not terrible either. Like they're pretty good. So if they can put it together on special teams, they're a real threat in the East, I think.
Yeah, their only downfall is special teams. And at the end of October and beginning of November, I'm really interested to see if they have sort of shorn that up, because if not, Brandon Banks coming to town, it could be a field day for him. And if they allow the Ticats to score on special teams, I don't know if they can hang with the Cats, because that defense in Hamilton is pretty darn good too. And I know he carved up Montreal, but I don't want to get too much into a game that's a month away, but let's just give props to the Red Blacks and that's all there is to it.
Now, on the Montreal side of thing, is Jim Popp's job in jeopardy if the Owls can't turn things around?
He's definitely not going to be the head coach next year. And I think if he forces that issue on Alouette's ownership, they might just tell him to hit the bricks.
Yeah.
I'm going to say he'll be back as general manager because I think he deserves the benefit of the doubt. Although this team, since I would say 2011, might be a good... No, even in 2012, they were pretty good. Basically, you know what? They've stunk since Calvillo got hurt and then had to retire. Mm-hmm. Let's be honest with you. Yeah. They've just haven't been able to find a replacement for Calvillo. And you can make an argument he's the greatest quarterback, if not player, in the history of the CFL. So it's not like he's going to be easily replaced, but they have just, Pop has not been able to find anyone capable of having continued success. Jonathan Crompton won a bunch of games, but his stats are horrible. He's consistently under 50%, if not under 40% completion percentage. Cato looks good in spurts, and then he seems to just lose it. I think that's sort of the problem in Montreal. Jim Pop has not been able to find the replacement for Anthony Calvillo, but I think he'll get another year at least to try to find that guy, because he's amassed enough goodwill to see this through.
All general managers and head coaches have an ego, but I think that he's been head coach a couple times in Montreal and it hasn't gone that great. So, you know, they come off a win against BC and then he cleans house and it's not going well for him. So I don't think he'll be head coach again. I agree with you there. Maybe he's back as GM, but, you know, maybe there's some turmoil there between Wetnall and Jim Pop because, you know, they hired Higgins without Jim Pop's approval, and then Pop fires Higgins and Clean gets the offensive coordinator there. Now Calvillo and Dinwiddie are running it and it's not looking good. So maybe if he didn't fire all those people, maybe the Alouettes are a better team right now, because, you know, they look really bad right now. And you know, they had that one win against Hamilton, and then since then Jim Pop's been behind, you know, he's been the head coach and it's just not been good for the Owls. So maybe his job is at jeopardy. He's been there for a long time. You know, you can't just... Maybe it's the end of the line for him in Montreal, and maybe he gets another job somewhere else. But
Are you talking yourself into thinking Jim Pop gets fired at the end of the year?
Maybe. Maybe he's run out of time with Wetnall. Maybe he's just done with him, and they need some fresh blood in Montreal.
Maybe you're right. Maybe they need some fresh blood. Maybe they need some fresh decision makers. I don't know who that would be. I'm not ready to sit here, you know, 5 weeks from the end of the regular season and decide who Montreal's next general manager might be. But you know, you're starting to convince me.
Yeah, he's been there since 96, so that's almost 20 years now. So that's a long time for a general manager to have his job. You know, maybe he gets the benefit of the doubt and has another year, but I could see him getting fired if the Owls, you know, go in the tank.
So the Esks defeated the Bombers in what was one of the wildest finishes to a game. I think I've, you know, Hamilton and Calgary had that this week, had that end of the game shanked punt and back-to-back field goals to win the game. That was a pretty wild ending. But this thing in Edmonton was, in Winnipeg was insane. And there's been a lot of chatter on social media following the game about the defensive pass interference call on Odell Willis. I saw a lot of Eskimo fans talking about how it was a phantom call. call and how the league was trying to make up for the mistake that the refs made against Winnipeg the week before. Now, I want your opinion on this, but before we get into that, I just want to say the idea that the refs would be in then on this multi-game conspiracy, that's the tinfoil hat wearing crowd thinking that stuff. People call the refs idiots and stupid and they don't know how to do their jobs. They can't be morons and at the same time pull off this elaborate cheating scandal to right previous wrongs. You can't have it both ways. You can't call the refs stupid and incompetent and then say that they're these evil geniuses that are dictating the outcomes of games. So what did you think of the pass interference call in Willis?
You know, if that was a Ticats game and that happened, I'd be pretty pissed, to be honest. I thought he timed it pretty well. I thought that, you know, maybe it was slightly before he got there, but I don't agree with the call. I think that that shouldn't have been a pass interference. Now, I don't think that the refs were trying to make up for a call or anything like that, but in my personal opinion, I wouldn't have thrown the flag on that. It was just too close. It seemed like Willis had perfect timing, so I wouldn't have made that call.
I agree. I think it's marginal at best. The problem is that once you made pass interference reviewable, you opened it up to these tiny minutia-like calls. He did hit him early. It may have been a nanosecond early, but you see his body connect with, I believe it was Rory Kohlert's body, before the ball gets there, and that is pass interference. This is what happens when you make these plays reviewable. It's going to come down to these microsecond plays, and look, maybe I would have been pretty angry if it had gone against the Ticats, but when cooler heads prevail, you look at it and you got to go, this is what happens when you make plays like this reviewable.
Yeah, that's true. They're going by the book, but it's just so close. And I don't think it's just a tough call and a tough call to swallow if you're an Eskimos fan. But, they pulled off the win. So
I look at it like this. Okay, sorry to cut you off. I look at it like this. Since the advent of video review, who the hell knows what a catch is anymore?
Yeah.
You see things and you're like, no, that's a catch, and they call it incomplete. And you see things and you're like, I don't think that was a catch, and they call it complete. You don't even know what a catch is anymore. It's gotten ludicrous. Now in the CFL, defensive pass interference is under the same sort of microscope. What's DPI and what's not DPI is, it's a fraction of a second now, just like with catches. So like I said, this is the can of worms you open when you make these things reviewable. I was not really all that for pass interference becoming a reviewable play. And now I'm sort of getting on the side of, if that's going to be reviewable and you're going to make a call like that on Willis, then you know what? Open up everything to review. Everything should be reviewable then. Because if we're going to take this into the realm of the absurd and live, that didn't look like pass interference, but on review, it definitely was pass interference. If we're going to do this now, we might as well just open up the floodgates and have everything be reviewable.
It's tough to call, you know. It's just hard to... It's such a judgment call on pass interference sometimes. So, you know, I was kind of for it, but it's hard to support it when there's pass interference calls like that. It's just so minute and, you know, minuscule that, like, you know, that's pass interference now. It's tough. It really is tough. You know, that kind of play could turn around a game in the playoffs and it could make a huge difference. So it's tough to watch when plays like that get called for pass interference. So on the Winnipeg side of the ball, you know, you got Liam Haralahu, who just had a really tough game. Is Liam Haralahu the kicker going forward for Winnipeg, or does he get cut this week after his poor performance against Edmonton?
I don't think he's going to get cut this week. Mike O'Shea seems to give his players a lot of rope. Now,
he's pretty loyal, right?
He is fairly loyal. Just before this week, Troy Studemeyer has been the return guy, and he had a punt return this week for a touchdown. That was really nice. But prior to that, he's been pretty ineffective as a return man and hasn't really seen much time on offense. And I know Winnipeg fans have been calling for him to get yanked and to put someone else in. I don't see O'Shea taking this kid out and going somewhere else. He was amazing last year. Yeah, and it just seems like I don't know if you're a golfer, I'm not, but I've heard of the term the yips. It seems like he's got the yips. How do you miss 4 field goals and an extra point? And he clunked an extra point off one goal post, and then the following field goal, he clanks off the other goal post. It just seems like his confidence is completely shot. But I know he's a good kicker because he has shown it in the past that he can be a good kicker. But that might have been one of the worst kicking performances I've ever seen. Although he nearly pulled off the Jamie Boreham special, which is miss a bunch of field goals than hit the game winner when time's expired. So if Edmonton doesn't drive and get that 53-yard field goal from Sean White, we're probably just talking about how he had a redemption game as opposed to him having the goat horns on, you know?
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. It's tough to hit the post twice in one game. He
It's tough to hit it once all season, let alone twice on back-to-back kicks.
Yeah, like, he was totally in his head, you know. He just missed a couple, and then he was thinking about it, and like you said, getting the yips, or like when a baseball player is that bad and he can't seem to hit the ball, like one of those things, it's just in his head. He just has to move on to the next game and try to have some success, because it was just a really, you know, the Winnipeg fans were really giving it to him, so yeah, I'm sure that didn't help, you know, the fans booing you after he missed two or three, and then he goes out and kicks the winning field goal. Look, like if he makes three of those field goals, the Bombers win. So it just seems that the Bombers can't catch a break. And I know we've talked about it this before, but man, oh man, they're having a tough time in Winnipeg pulling out wins. So I agree. I think O'Shea's going to hold on to him. I don't think he's going to get cut. And hopefully, I'm hoping for the guy that he has to bounce back game and nail some field goals in this week's game.
Yeah, I'm with you. I hope the kid bounces back and sort of finds his rhythm again, because he was a good kicker last year. So I know he has it in him. So even though we're not Bombers fans, I'm rooting for the guy to turn it around.
So, right. You know, the next game is pretty much we just have to talk about John Jennings.
Yeah, I mean, there's one guy.
What a performance.
Insane. I don't know if I've ever seen a young quarterback play this well. I'm sure I've said this before about you. I'm sure we said this about Rakeem Cato earlier. We might have even said this about Brett Smith. Both those guys have had good games. But here are the numbers. 19 to 25. 364 yards, 4 passing touchdowns, 40 rushing yards, and the dude caught a 21-yard TD.
A tough catch, too.
In traffic, he takes a hit. Yeah. Like, are you kidding me? My only sort of caveats here, and this is not in any way meant to diminish Jennings, because holy crap, was he good, is that it was against Saskatchewan's defense, and I know we talked earlier about how fans might dismiss a good Jeff Matthews performance against a terrible Saskatchewan defense, and we both sort of, yeah, that might be silly, but that is definitely a caveat, because Saskatchewan's defense is horrible. That doesn't mean he didn't play tremendously. But my second one is that Quinton Porter had a phenomenal second career start. He was 27 of 32, threw for 5 touchdowns for 429 yards against the Montreal Alouettes, and he never really developed anything past that. He sort of stayed as what he was, and that was sort of an anomaly and not a sign of things to come. But even having said that, BC finds quarterbacks. Wally Buono knows how to scout quarterbacks. If I was an owner of a team, I'd want Wally Buono to find my quarterbacks, and I would want Jim Barker to find my wide receivers, because that seems to be what those two guys know how to do. But yeah, whew, what a game by Jonathan Jennings.
Yeah, all of a sudden, you know, Arsenault's catching balls, making plays. You know, he looks like the receiver that we expected him to be. You know, he's just, I said last week, I don't want to jump on the Jennings train too quick, because, you know, I've been burned a couple times, but
we're hopping on, buddy.
Yeah. Like, you know, I jumped on the Cato train earlier this season, but I don't know, maybe Jennings is different. He just looks outstanding. He throws the ball well. He's running the ball well. He's catching the ball well. So maybe BC turns it on late in the season, and maybe they become a contender in the West, because they looked really, really good on offense. You know, they got Hawkins coming in. You know, he's been playing lights out since he's been starting for the Lions. He's a real weapon. You know, they have a pretty good receiving corps over there. So, you know, maybe BC steps up and gets that third playoff spot and makes some noise in the playoffs.
I'm not sure if they'll make a bunch of noise in the playoffs. I still think that Calgary and Edmonton are too strong, but they might make the playoffs. And a few weeks ago, we were handing the third seed in the West to the Alouettes. And man, do we look like idiots, because the Alouettes have completely fallen off the map. And BC all of a sudden is making a run with a quarterback that we never thought would play this season. So it could be
the line. Yeah, it's a shame that Beck got all that time. You know, they would have went with Jennings. You never know what could have happened when Lulie got injured. So, and then there's another question. Is Jennings keeps playing well, is Lulie going to be the starter again, you know? So it's interesting right now in BC, all of a sudden.
Jennings' emergence sort of reminds me of Lulie's back in 2010. Lulie wasn't the starter going into that season. I think it was, it wasn't Casey Printers. Who the heck was the starting quarterback for the BC Lions that year going into the season? I don't remember who it was. I'm sure someone will remind us, but I'm drawing a blank. I know Casey Printers at one point was the starter, and then, maybe it was Casey Printers, because he came, no, it was, I think it was Casey Printers, because Casey Printers started the playoff game against Hamilton and Iverwin in 2009. Maybe Printers started going into the season. Anyways, and then he sort of had that meltdown against Winnipeg, I think it was. He threw an interception for a touchdown to lose a game, and he just lost it on the sidelines, and they released him and threw Lulie in there, and the Lions went on a bit of a run. They made the playoffs, but they lost in the first round to,
Saskatchewan.
I think it was Saskatchewan, because that's, yeah, you're right. They lost to Saskatchewan. one, but you could sort of see that Lule was going to be the guy to guide them for the, well, what we thought was going to be for the next 10 years ended up not being as long. Maybe this is sort of the same thing that's happening with Jennings. He's going to have this run here at the end. Maybe they lose a close game in the first round of the playoffs, but then in 2011, BC started slowly, but then went on to win the Grey Cup. Maybe the same thing can happen with Jonathan Jennings. Who knows?
Yeah, and maybe he's the starter next year, you know, full-time starter. He certainly has the tools and the potential, so it'll be interesting to see how he plays down the stretch here in the last five or six games.
Is there any chance that you have an idea of what Lule's contract situation is like? Is he a free agent at the end of the year, or does he have another year left on his deal? Because maybe there's a quarterback competition in camp between Jennings and Lule.
Yeah, it could be. I recall that he got signed the year after the Grey Cup.
To an extension.
Victory. Yeah, I'm not sure how long that was. It might have been 3 years.
Yeah, it might be coming up then. He might be able to hit the market. So maybe the Riders, Jesus. We didn't talk about the Riders, so I got Riders on the head. The Lions will, maybe they'll let Lule go and ride with Jennings until he earns himself a contract extension. Because, again, it's about saving money. They're not paying Jennings all that much. He's making rookie money, maybe a little bit more than a normal rookie would make, but he's making rookie money for a quarterback. That will open up the pocketbook to bring in players around him on offense or on defense. Maybe that's the way the Lions are going to go. Who knows?
Yeah, that could be a big opportunity for the Lions for sure, you know. If Jennings can guide the offense to victory, then go with the cheaper talent and then fill your roster with more highly paid players to build around him and then give him the big money when his contract's up. So he could be the guy.
So I have Riders on the brain because this Friday, the Ticats are hosting the Saskatchewan Rough Riders. This is a gotta-win game, right?
Not a must-win, but, you know, they have to... They have to get a win under the belt with Matthews behind center to get some confidence in the offense going forward.
Yeah, if they don't win this game, I think we're going to see a lot of anxious and angry people in Tiger Town. I might even be one of them. If they can't beat a 2-12 team, even with a backup quarterback, this season might be a complete write-off.
They got to win this one. They can't. That would be embarrassing. And, you know, teams will be licking their lips and like, hey, you know, the Riders beat the Ticats. The Ticats aren't that great anymore. So, you know, they'll have a lot of confidence going against Hamilton. So they have to make a statement. They have to put a beat down on the Riders this upcoming weekend because they just can't. They just can't lose to a 2-12 team.
Big key to this game is just not turning the damn ball over. If they don't have turnovers, they might have beaten Calgary and Edmonton. So don't turn the ball over in this team, this defense. Look, I think of it this way. If Hamilton can score three touchdowns, I don't think they will lose to anybody. They lost 23-20 to the Stampeders. Essentially, Calgary scored three touchdowns. You know what I mean?
Yep.
Just if and a team like Saskatchewan that's not very good, if the Ticats can get in the end zone three times and not turn the damn ball over, I don't think they lose this game. And I think we need to see a lot more of Michael Ford. We fluffed him a little bit earlier. I think he is very impressive. I would like to see him get 15 or so touches. He had 14. I think he had 10 carries and 4 catches. I'd like to see something similar, maybe even a little more. Maybe get him in close to the 18 to 20 touches range and let that guy take the pressure off a young quarterback, because I think he may not be something special. He's not a CJ Gable type, but he can be a solid contributor on this team.
Exactly. You got to take the pressure off of Matthews. You know, let him throw the ball, but don't make him win the game. You're right. If they can just manage, if they can score a couple touchdowns on offense and just let the defense do their thing, and they'll be all right. So I don't really like, I think game manager is used a bit too much for quarterbacks. But in this case, I think he has to not throw interceptions, not fumble the ball, and just run, let the talented receivers and talented running backs do their thing and just manage the game.
I'm more concerned about the fumbles than I am the interceptions. I think the interception against Calgary was more a case of the wind taking the ball, because it looked like Tasker was open on the play and it just sailed over his head. I know they were going against the wind. Maybe he put a little bit too much on it to sort of compensate for that, but it's the fumbles. He's had two fumbles, killer fumbles, this especially against Calgary, where they were driving and looked poised to at least get a field goal attempt out of it, and he gets stripped of the ball at like the 25 or 15 yard line, something like that.
Yeah.
Cannot have turnovers, especially in the red zone. So again, if he just protects the football, I think Hamilton's got a really good shot of winning this football game.
Yeah, they should win this game. They're the better team than Saskatchewan. So you're right. If he just doesn't turn over the ball, I think they'll be all right.
Is there anything defensively you're sort of looking at them to do? I think they just got to pressure Kevin Glenn into making mistakes. Mm-hmm. We talked about him a bit earlier. He had three turnovers against BC, and BC's defense is not exactly, you know, the 1985 Chicago Bears. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And just keep Jarrell Messam in check. I know that's difficult to do, but if the Ticats can get an early lead, maybe a special teams touchdown, maybe the offense gets into a rhythm early and scores. If they get up two touchdowns, touchdowns or they get up 17 points, something like that, that will take Messam out of the game because the Riders won't be able to run if they have to play catch up.
Yeah, and I'm not sure if they're going to start Glenn or if they're going to go with Smith. So either way.
I think Bob Dice said after the game that Glenn is starting.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Which is kind of silly in my estimation, but that's another topic for another day.
Yeah. So yeah, you're right. Glenn kind of folds under pressure. He'll throw those picks. And if you can shut down the tandem of Messam and Allen, then that's pretty much it for the Riders. They're not going to produce much more if we shut those three elements down. So, the defense is more than capable of doing it. So if the defense has a strong performance and the offense has a average to pretty good performance, we should easily beat the Saskatchewan Roughriders.
If they can't win this game...
You're in trouble.
Yeah, we're in trouble. Simple as that. Bold predictions? You got what do you got this week?
All right, I'm going to go with Tasker. I think that, Matthews and Tasker have the history. So I'm not going to go too overboard, but I think he'll have 100 yards and a touchdown. And that's a little bold because of the way that Matthews has played so far. So not too bold, but, medium bold.
Yeah. It's a medium salsa compared to the hot picante that we usually have to throw up here.
Yeah, exactly.
But it's hard to be too bold because the offense is, if Zach Collaros was still here, I think we could be a lot bolder with these predictions. But mine is, I got 100 plus yards and a touchdown, but mine is coming from Michael Ford. I think the team is going to rely on him. And he had 50 yards rushing, and if not for an errant flying foot of Terrell Sinkfield, probably would have had another 40 or so on a big carry and maybe a touchdown. So he looks to be a guy that can break one, and I think he's going to break one against Saskatchewan, and I think he's going to have the second 100-yard rushing game of the season after CJ Gables.
Yeah, I could see that happening. And I'd love to see that happen because we've been talking about it all year. We've got to get the running game going, especially now with Claro there.
All right. Last segment. This is yours. We got some questions. I got three. How many do you have?
I believe I have three as well.
Would you like to go first? Or would you like me to go first?
I'll go first, I guess.
All right.
Now, USFL Tecmo sent us one, but I kind of asked you earlier, so we already covered it. Do you think Pop is finished in Montreal? So we already talked about that. But he has another one. Do the Riders have any sort of plan, or are they just winging it?
Sure as hell doesn't look like they have any sort of plan, does it? I don't know what they're doing. They're 2-12. They're not making the playoffs. I think I heard that their chances of making the playoffs going into last week was 0.1%. They're done. They are done. It's time to play the young guys. Why Kevin Glenn is starting against Hamilton, I will never know. I don't think Bob Dice, who's the interim head coach, has any chance of being named the permanent head coach. I just don't see any reason why this team is not playing young people. And yeah, to me, it just sounds like they do not know what the hell they're doing right now.
They had the slight, very slight possibility of climbing up and catching, maybe one of the Western teams or, snatching that third playoff spot when he took over and that Glenn came back healthy and he thought, hell, if we pull off this miracle, maybe I'll get a job, a head coaching job permanent. So maybe that's what they were thinking. But, that's so slim that it's just start Smith. He has a little bit of potential. See what he's got. And I'm babbling a bit here, but I think they're just winging it, to be honest. So yeah, on to the next one.
Look, they have four games left, and the most they can get to now is six wins. They've already lost the season series to BC, and BC right now has five wins. So one more win by the Lions in their remaining five games, and the Lions have knocked the Saskatchewan Roughriders out of the playoffs because the Riders are not going right now. The third place team in the East is Toronto with seven wins, so the Riders can't cross over. And if BC gets to six wins, the Riders can't get to third. So they are one loss or one BC win away from being eliminated from the playoffs entirely. So maybe after this Hamilton game, they will figure out that it's time to look and see what they have for next year.
Paul underscore Barnes, who do you blame for the time count violation late in the fourth, Matthews or the coaching staff?
Now, here's the thing with this, is when we were sitting in the stands, my friend that I talked about earlier, Richard, who was like, I've had enough of this. When he's not making extreme proclamations, he does sort of see things that I don't. And one of the things he saw was Terrell Sinkfield try to call a timeout before the clock hit zero.
Yes, I saw that too on TV. I thought he did get, like, he was signaling timeout before the time count violation happened, but I guess the ref just didn't see it, so I don't know what happened there.
Now, can receivers call timeouts? Because I think it's the NFL, where it's only the quarterback and and the head coach that can call timeouts. I could be completely wrong on this, but I'm pretty sure I remembered hearing that. I'm not sure if there's something similar in the CFL, but to me, it's hard to sort of place any blame on it if there was at least one guy on the field who was trying to ensure that that penalty didn't happen. I guess if you had to place blame, I guess you could go on both, because Matthew should have been more cognizant of where the play clock was, but so too should have the coaching staff. They all should have been screaming for a timeout when that clock got to 2 seconds, like Sinkfield was.
Yeah, that's an interesting question with can other players on the field but the quarterback call timeout, because I'm not sure either. So, you know, maybe Mark can look into that or something. So, yeah, I'm agreeing with you. Maybe it's just both of them, a little bit of blame for the coach, a little bit of blame for Matthews, because they both should know when that clock's ticking down, and if they don't have the play in place that they want, they should have called the timeout. So, a little bit of blame for both.
And that was a killer penalty to take, too, because it cost them a down. It stopped the clock. It essentially gave Calgary an extra 30 or so seconds, because if the Ticats got that playoff, it would have ended maybe 5-6 seconds later. Then they could have run off another 20 seconds and punted the ball instead. Yeah. They punted the ball away on a dead clock. That was not, we're not going to sit here and blame it on one call, but that was a death blow that really helped Calgary steal that win.
Yeah, that was a hard one to take, a big mistake on their parts. So yeah, that one stung for sure.
All right, so you're done with your questions. I guess I'll ask mine. Yeah. I got three in the comment section of Three Down Nation, all from the same commenter who goes by the name of Adam. And his first one is, with injuries to Canadian wide receivers, should the Ticats start Butler at Sam linebacker and Daly at free safety and start another American wide receiver?
That's an interesting question, because Daly's been playing really well when he's been in there, and Butler has experience at linebacker position when he played with the Rough Riders. So that might be a good idea, you know, stick another American receiver in there, get some as much talent on the field as you can, you know. Not to say that there's not talented Canadian receivers on this team, but, well, with all the injuries, maybe that is the right way to go.
Hamilton is down to their third string receiver in, I think it's Giovanni Aprile, I think that's his name.
Yeah.
Like, they're down Fantuz and they're down Coates. And even though Coates was a major step down from Fantuz, he had played admirably and wasn't really asked of much. But that killer drop by Aprile that we talked about earlier was, maybe this is the way to go. At first, I was really reluctant to go with this, because if you put Butler down there at linebacker, you're taking essentially Eric Harris off the field as a starter.
Mm, yeah.
And Eric Harris is a great playmaking linebacker out there. And then I started thinking, well, maybe the Ticats, instead of doing a four-man front, three linebackers, five DBs, maybe they go to a 4-4-4 to keep Harris on the field. And if you go to the Ticats website, Eric Harris is listed as a defensive back. Mm-hmm. So it's entirely possible that they could go with a front four of Hickman, Laurent, Hall, and Norwood, or Tracy, or whomever is at other end when guys aren't hurt. Then they have Simone Lawrence, Taylor Reed, Harris, and Butler in the linebacking core. And then you can throw out Daly at safety. And I'm working off of everyone being healthy. You'd have Emmanuel Davis in the secondary. You'd have Rico Murray out there. Then you could put, like, Jaleel Carter could be out there, or maybe Johnny Sears, or even Brandon Stewart. It might allow for the team to do this. And if it allows for a guy like Taquan Underwood to get back on the field, it might be something the team should look at.
Yeah, it's a very good question on that commenter's part, because that's a realistic option that they could look at.
Again, like I said, I was reluctant to give this consideration, but then when I started thinking about it, might not be a terrible move. So we'll see. His second question pertains to the secondary. And he asks, if everyone is healthy, who are your starting five? I went down the roster to get all the DBs that this team has, and this is not an easy question to answer. There's Craig Butler, Jaleel Carter, Mike Daly, Emmanuel Davis, Ed Gainey, Courtney Steven, Brandon Stewart, Donald Washington, Rico Murray, and Johnny Sears. Your guess is as good as mine as to who your starting five should be.
I like what Johnny Sears brought to the table earlier in the season, so I put him in there. Like Donald Washington, love Rico Murray, Courtney Stevens. Steven is a great Canadian defensive back, so he's got to be in there. Ed Gainey has had a tough year at times, so I'm not sure he'd be in there. Jaleel Carter is going to be in there, so yeah, it's tough. There's so much talent, but did you pick a starting five?
I had a hard time doing it, but I did. Obviously, I'm starting Steven and Butler, because we need those guys for a ratio purposes. So that takes care of the safety position and the wide side corner position. Emmanuel Davis to me is an all-star, and we have a question. Our final question of the week is about Emmanuel Davis and outstanding player awards. So there's no way in hell I'm taking him off the field. He is one of the halfbacks. Rico Murray, when he's healthy, is a stud at halfback, but he can also play that short side corner. And I love Donald Washington when he played, but I think I got to go with Johnny Sears. If Johnny Sears is healthy, I think he plays another halfback position, because he was really good too. too. And that leaves a guy like Jahlil Carter and Donald Washington and Brandon Stewart, who has been pretty good this year. And he's been a backup guy all season and a special teams guy. And I think he started when necessary. So he's on the bench. He's coming in as sort of maybe he'd be the designated import, or maybe he'd just be a backup. I don't know what you would do with him. Ed Gainey to me is a non-starter. I think he's been, I don't want to say terrible, but he hasn't really shown me anything to warrant him even having a game day roster spot. So he's definitely not starting. And honestly, I think if all these guys were healthy, I don't think Jahlil Carter is signed by the Ticats. Mm-hmm. I think they only brought him in because of Washington's hurt, Murray's hurt, Sears is hurt. I think that's the only reason that he got signed by the team, and he's a good player. But I think if Hamilton had all their defensive backs healthy, I don't think we see him here. So yeah, my starting five is Butler, Steven, Murray, Sears, and Davis.
Washington was really good, but I'm going to have to agree with you. You know, Sears made so many plays at the start of the season, so I'm going to agree with the five that you have with Butler and Steven. You know, being them Canadian, it's big for the ratio, but they're also great players, so I'm going to have to go with your five as well.
Davis, Murray, and Sears are ball hawks. Washington was good, but he was more of a hard hitter. He tapes his fingers, and I think I said this before, but he reminded me of Sean Taylor, the sadly departed defensive back that played for the Washington Redskins, went to the University of Miami. He taped his fingers, and I think it was Chad Johnson I saw one time say, if you see a guy with taped fingers as a DB, you know he's going to knock your head off when he hits you. I remember Donald Washington's sack on Trevor Harris. I believe it was the Civic Holiday game. Just took him out, and it was like one of the nicest hits I've ever seen. I would love to get him on the field somehow, but you can't take Davis off the field. Murray is a ball hawk. Sears has proven to be a ball hawk, and you need those two Canadian guys out there who aren't just out there because they're Canadians. They are very talented players, but you need those guys out there for the ratio. So it's unfortunately hard to find a place for Donald Washington. And man, at the start of the season, the secondary was a huge question mark. And now we look at it and go, we have too many guys that are talented in this back five. It's a good problem to have.
They're totally stacked at DBs. So it's so much talent. It's hard to get them all in the field. So, you know, like you said, it's a great problem to have. And I'm really happy about it. You know, the defense is really strong. So it's great to have great DBs back there.
It'll make for some interesting competition at training camp next year. And while we're still in the heat of this year, looking forward to next year, this team looks to be just as loaded and ready to compete for a championship again next year. So exciting times ahead for the Ticats. Last question, so before we get out of here, pertains to Emmanuel Davis. And it's very simple. Is he the East's defensive most outstanding player?
He's a candidate, I'd say, for sure. You know, he's had lots of picks. He's been playing great all year. It's a couple pick sixes. So he's a top candidate for sure. I can't even really think of who else would be a top candidate in the East. Like off the top of my head, he has to be one or two or three for the top defensive player in the league in the East for sure.
Took the words right out of my mouth, buddy. I looked to see who sort of is his competition. And two names that stuck out on other teams were Winston Venable of Montreal. Okay. He has 71 tackles, three sacks, and a fumble recovery this year. And he's been pretty good. In games I've watched the Owls play, he's probably been their best linebacker. He's been all over the field making plays. I really like him as a player. And the other guy that's not with the Ticats was Greg Jones, the Argos linebacker. He has 66 tackles, two sacks, and an interception. And he's been sort of all over the field for that Argos defense that hasn't been great by any stretch of the imagination, which we all knew because Casey Crehan is the defensive coordinator there, and he quite frankly sucks at his job. But Jones has been really, really good for the Argos. My only concern with Davis being named the East nominee is he might not get the nomination from the Ticats. Simone Lawrence has had an excellent year as well, and he was named the team's defensive most outstanding player last year when everyone thought it would go to Eric Norwood, when Norwood had something like 14 sacks and had a huge second half. So while I think Davis does have a shot at the award, probably not the league's award, but definitely the East's award, he could fall victim to what happened to Jamel Richardson back in 2011 when he finished with nearly 1,800 receiving yards, but Calvillo got the nomination for the Alouettes, and therefore Richardson couldn't win the award when he probably should have been MOP that year. Travis Lule ended up winning, who had a good season. Calvillo had a good season too, but Richardson was head and shoulders above everyone else. The same thing could happen to Davis with the Ticats this year. He might not get the nomination, and if that happens, he can't be the East nominee, obviously.
Yeah, it's a victim of, you know, a really talented defense with great players, so I'm sure that he'd love to have the award, but I'm sure he'd be proud for Lawrence if he got it too. So, you know, it's just a great problem to have when you have so many talented players on defense.
It's also historically defensive backs have not really gotten a ton of praise and a ton of award nominations. I looked it up. Javon Johnson is the only player to play defensive back that has ever won most outstanding defensive player. He won it in 2011 with that ridiculous Bombers team that their defense was off the charts good. But aside from him, only five other players have ever even been nominated as the East's most outstanding defensive player as a DB. Baron Miles in 2002 with the Alouettes, Paul Bennett with the 85 Ticats, Harry Skipper with the 84 Montreal Concords, Zach Henderson with the 82 Argos. And this is the only reason I bring these guys up is because this guy here who played for the 78 Montreal Alouettes may have the best name for a defensive player I've ever heard. Maybe rivals Bryce Pop, an old linebacker that played for the Bills and the Packers. His name was Randy Rhino. Are you kidding me when it comes to names? Your name's Rhino? He must have been a truck to hit. Yeah. Oh, what a name.
Yeah, and the first name goes well with it too. You know, Randy Rhino, you know, two R's, you know, that's a beauty right there.
Oh my God, that goes in the name Hall of Fame as far as I'm concerned. If my name was Rhino, imagine the things you could accomplish if your name was Mike Rhino. Oh, what a name. Oh man, I saw that and I want to see film on this guy because I just can only imagine he must have hit like a Mack truck even as a defensive back.
Yeah, I can't say I've ever heard of Randy Rhino, so I have to look him up, see what Rhino is all about.
We got to find a way to get his name in every podcast because that's my favorite name. I think it might be my favorite name ever of any human being that's ever existed on earth. Randy Rhino.
It's pretty great.
Oh man, what an awesome name. So we get to end on Randy Rhino, which is a good as place as any to end this show. So as always, don't forget that you can subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. And if you want to have your questions answered, you can hit Mike or myself up on Twitter. As always, buddy, give him that Twitter handle.
Mike_Ticats.
And I'm at @JoshSmith_82. And be like Adam. Post questions on the 3Down Nation comment section. Those were three excellent questions we got this week. Gave us some great discussion. I loved them. Keep them coming.
Yeah, I love reading the comments when we put the show up on 3Down Nation. So comment away because I love hearing feedback.
So that is Podski Wee Wee for this week. I'm Josh Smith.
I'm Mike Graham. Eat 'em raw.
Eat 'em raw.